On our site, you can find local jazz musicians' albums to buy, contact musicians for video lessons or personalized concerts, and pitch in to artist relief funds. Artists can sign up for our free musicians listing and learn about financial resources that are available to them.
The DC jazz community will get through this together.
To learn more, head to capitalbop.com and click COVID-19.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone from the county. From another man done gone.
Huh? I don't know. What? I'm just going across the street.
Shut your mouth.
Oh, no. What'd I do?
Turn around. Turn around. Put your hands behind your back. Let's go.
The jury of your peers, having found you guilty, 10 years.
What? Come on, get in that cell.
I was in jail too, man. It's cold-blooded in the jail. You go down there looking for justice. That's what you find, just us.
Welcome to another edition of Crossroads Today. Now here's your host, Roach Brown.
And welcome on this beautiful January day. It's warm outside. I want to thank you for joining us on the last day of Trump's presidency. Everybody's waiting and expecting. D.C., has been shut down. I mean, it's like an armed town downtown. You can't go below certain streets, and you can't. Most of the bridges are closed. So this is really has impacted everybody in Washington D.C. and across the country. So we'll see what happens after this afternoon. Joining us this morning, as always, is my good friend and co-host Nikisha Taifa. Our guest for this morning, called in council. Those things happen from time to time. We had Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, the delegate of Washington, D.C. She had to call and counsel due to some business up on the hill that's more urgent. We'll get it back at another time. But we have another gentleman joining us named Galen Boffman, who was a civil commitment. He was committed civilly to an institution for violent sexual predators. And this man was kept years in prison, which you will hear the story when we come back. But before we start, we open up what we call the grapevine. Information that you can use. The grapevine. Here we go. All right, that's it then. That was a short one. All right, here we go. Biden's judicial picks should include lawyers who battled the government in court. The incoming president can bring some much needed professional diversity to the federal bench. Libertarians are sure to be unhappy with plenty of incoming President Joe Biden's judicial picks. But there's one glimmer of hope on the courtroom front. The Huffington Post reports that the Biden team is looking to bring some much needed professional diversity to the federal bench. In a letter obtained by the Huffington Post, Biden's incoming White House counsel, Dana Remus, tells Democratic senators to try to find public defenders and civil rights attorneys and defense attorneys in their states who they think would be a good fit for a federal judgeship. With respect to U.S. District Court positions, we are particularly focused on nominating individuals whose legal experience have been historically underrepresented on the federal bench, including those who are public defenders, civil rights and legal aid attorneys, and those who represent America in every walk of life. That's the issue that should have been addressed a long time ago in this overhaul of the criminal justice system. We need to have a diversity of federal judges, man, from all walks of life, not just from the prosecutor side of the government. We need lawyers to be appointed to the federal bench from all walks of the criminal justice field. So that way we can get a diverse reading from them people going in front of these judges. So that is a good recommendation. We hope Mr. Biden sticks to that when he gets into the office. People in prison earn credits by participating in educational, vocational, and other programs, as well as complying with prison rules. The call for more states to use their good time policies to release people from prison during the COVID-19 epidemic. With the COVID-19 infection rate in prison four times that of the general U.S. population, public health and medical experts are urging prisons to reduce their population to save lives. But governors and correctional officials are still passing the buck. And almost a year into the pandemic, overlooking existing mechanisms that could be used to release people, states have instead imposed a number of policy changes that have caused further harm to the incarcerated people they are supposed to protect. Correctional agencies have suspended programs, classes, and other valuable resources for incarcerated people. Not only does suspending programs make life in prison more difficult, it also slows down upcoming releases. People who have been approved for parole are still waiting behind bars to complete programs required by them as a condition of their release by the parole board. So states and the federal government need to use more innovative policies that you have on the books to release them in, because 4 out of 5 people inside of prison are catching this virus. Please, people, step up and do something and let these people out. Virginia State Crime Commission votes to eliminate mandatory minimum sentences. And that's a plus. Proposal would eliminate mandatory jail and prison terms attached to 224 of offenses. Members of the Virginia State Crime Commission recently voted overwhelmingly to endorse legislation stripping all mandatory minimum sentences from state codes. The sweeping proposal, which lawmakers plan to introduce when the General Assembly convenes this week, would eliminate mandatory jail and prison terms attached to 224 offenses that range from drunken driving to child rape. Whew, that's something that needs to be happening all over the country. Eliminate mandatory minimums and put the discretion back in the hands of the judge. Let the judge decide whether or not somebody should get a longer sentence or a shorter sentence. And that's been the Grapevine, information that you can use. Good morning, Nikisha Taifa.
Good morning, Roach Brown. How are you, my brother?
Oh, it's good, boy. It's so good to see you on Tuesday morning when we're on this radio, because I know you, boy, we're going to do a good job with this. I want to thank
you.
Well,
I just want to say I am absolutely and completely pumped up because, as you know, my client, William Underwood, was granted compassionate release and he's out of prison today. Oh, so I might not be on, be kind of off and on because I'm just waiting for that moment, but I just wanted to really thank you, Roach Brown, Mertine, Crossroads, the whole WPFW family for keeping William Underwood in your prayers and for forever always uplifting his voice. After 33 years, 67 years old, he was finally granted a compassionate release and he will be walking out inshallah this morning.
What does that mean? What does that mean, Nikisha? He got released on compassion release. For those folk who don't understand or know what that means, what does that mean, compassion
release? Actually, you know, well, first of all, he's a COVID-19 survivor. He has been just a model prisoner. He's been helping a lot of the younger folk avoid, you know, the types of pitfalls that folk get in. He has served his whole time without one incident, misconduct report. The judge even mentioned that, you know, he found it incredulous that after 33 years, not even a ticket for an unkempt cell or for talking back to an officer. The judge also, you know, really talked about everything that he has accomplished. There was another judge who spoke out in his, in his favor. Okay, so I'm just checking my texts and going through because we're doing this minute by minute. And, you know, the family has been waiting for this moment for over, you know, 3 days. Yeah. So, again, I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't know what to say. I'm just really speechless because I've been in this battle for 10 years. It's been a 10-year battle with respect to trying to get him released. So, so we're just taking this minute by minute.
So where's he been released from? Where's he been released from?
From Fairton Federal
New Jersey.
In New Jersey, yeah. That's correct.
And he got family up in New York. His daughter's, Ebony's up in New York. She's right across the river.
Oh, yes, family, daughter Ebony, son Anthony, and his other daughter Miko, another son Justin, 4, who were children or teens when he was arrested. They're now all, much older adults, shall we say.
Okay. So you're waiting for any moment now to call that he's been released physically.
That's correct. Yep, okay. That he actually walked out into the arms of family. They are at the prison right now waiting for him to come out.
Okay.
So, okay. Amen.
Thanks. And we've been talking about his show, about him on this show for a couple of years, and we got a few more people we got to get out of there, because I got a friend just come on last week, a couple weeks ago, named Linwood Gray. He's been in about late 28 or 30 years. There's so many people that's being locked up 20, 30, 40 years. This stuff got to stop, people. It ain't right. That 30 years destroy your whole life. You don't have a life.
I mean,
when you
one year, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, yeah. You know, something's got to be done about this mass incarceration.
And
we need a mass movement, as Kara Gotch, my colleague, says. We need a mass movement to overcome this mass incarceration.
We sure do. And I'm glad to hear that William Underwood is out, because I never met him, but we've been pressing it, speaking on this case for years, him and a few other folk. Folks, this ain't right. They can lock people up 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Then expect them to come out and find a job. A job doing what? What can they do after 30, 40 years? You know what I mean? You got people in the street who never been to jail and can't find a job. And you expect somebody after 30, 40 years to come out and find a job. So whatever help we can be to assist him, Akeisha, there's another gentleman just coming up in 34 years named Guy Fisher. Was in that big New York case back in the 70s and 80s. Rudy Giuliani convicted them, or was a prosecutor with Guy Fisher and his whole crew back there. Nicky Barnes, that was supposedly the ringleader, and all them guys got life and line of big times. And Guy Fisher did 34 years, got 4 degrees, wrote 4 plays, wrote 4 books, never got a shot, and helped people out. And you got people being locked up 20, 30, 40 years doing all this good work. They can do this in the street to help save our kids and turn some people's lives around and stop some of this violence in our community. So these men need to come back out and contribute. And also, I'd like to think that because he's just coming out, William Underwood, everybody that do 25 years should get a $10,000 loan or $25,000
loan.
Of $20,000, a grant. Yeah. If you do 25 years in prison, you need $25,000 to $30,000 just to cool out and just try to get your life back in order. So that money from the prisons that are making from the telephones and from the commissary, that money should go into a fund account to give these men and women a grant when they come out. And they shouldn't pay taxes for the first 5 years. Because you've been gone 34, what are you going to pay taxes for? For what? You don't get no benefit from them taxes. So there's some things that we'll be talking about on this show, Kanichi, to help them men and women who've been locked up these long periods of time to come out and see what
kind of happened. Also, folks, that's important to really understand that it's not about the nature of what the conviction was, but how the person has changed and what their lives are now, today, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years later. You're never the same person that you were back in the day. You know what I'm saying? If people really believe in the scriptures and, you know, all that redemption and mercy and, you know, and all that, what is critical is, what are you doing today?
How have you
made a difference? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, our guest this morning, we got a guest on this morning called Galen Boffman. He was convicted in the back, and he used that civil commitment to lock him up. And civil commitment is something that a lot of folks are not familiar with. We talked about it a few times about Galen and a couple other guys on this show. Galen, are you there?
Hey, Roach. It's so good to hear your voice
good
in
morning.
The free world.
Okay. I'm glad to have you with us, man. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. And you've been home how long?
So I've been home about 5 months now. And this is after, going back into the system for 4 years, 3 months, and 2 weeks on a technical violation that did not carry any jail time under the Virginia Sentencing Guidelines.
Okay. You want to explain to our listeners exactly what a civil commitment is for those folk who are not aware of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a confusing term because civil commitment also is generally used to refer to a legitimate system that, you know, also has some critics of involuntary psychiatric commitment. So it's the concept that somebody has a serious mental disorder, and as a result is having difficulty caring for themselves or, you know, could be a danger to themselves or others. And so they're held in a hospital setting for treatment, and then they're released promptly when treatment is completed. And what happened in the late 80s and early 90s at the tail end of the truth in sentencing laws in this country, where lawmakers were essentially abolishing parole, and which I'm sure your listeners know all about, and instituting systems where they had to serve usually 85% at least of the sentence that the judge handed down. What happened was that people, so lawmakers found that they wanted to keep holding people under a parole-like system, but didn't have the legal opportunity. So what they did was they used the traditional medical model of civil commitment to smuggle in a back door around the constitutional protections against ex post facto law and double jeopardy. So just to make really clear to your listeners, this is a system designed to lock people up twice for the same crime. Or another way to look at it is they're punishing for you for what you might do in the future. This is what we call pre-crime preventative detention.
And that's a, now they lock you up, they can lock you up on civil commitment for what they think you might do in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. In my personal case, I was out in the free world for 4 years. I did not commit any new criminal acts. And at the, you know, based on a technical violation, which, you know, many criminal justice reform advocates now feel very strongly should never lead to someone being in a locked environment, in a carceral setting. They used that as a bogus basis to claim that I was too dangerous to be released. I'm explaining this slightly backwards, but when I finished my prison sentence originally in 2009, I had been locked up when I was 19 for a consensual relationship with someone who was underage. He was in high school. I was in college. I was supposed to get out in November of 2009, and 3 weeks before my release date, I got papers from the state saying that they would not honor my release date, that the Virginia Attorney General's office had unilaterally petitioned the state to indefinitely detain me under the label that I was, quote, so likely to commit a future act of violence that I constitute a menace to the health and safety of others, right? So likely menace. And I was then held for 28 months in jails and prisons, most of that time in solitary confinement at the Arlington County Jail. Wow. And this is a system where they're claiming that they're not punishing you, right? The pretension, the lie that they told the U.S. Supreme Court is that the intent here is not punishment, and therefore they call it civil, quote-unquote, as opposed to it being in criminal law. But I can tell you, Roach, solitary confinement for 28 months past my release date, that's absolutely punishment, and the lawmakers torture. Know that.
Yeah. That's torture. I know about solitary. That's torture. You just said something. You serve your time waiting to be released, and you get a letter from the Attorney General state that they're not going to honor your release. They're going to hold you indefinitely and hold you for 20-some months and place you in solitary without a charge, without a case, and your time was up. Is that what you just said?
Yes, sir. Yeah, so for all the listeners, the United States, people are absolutely held in 20 states in the federal government. People are being held in prison and in jails in explicitly punitive environments after they have already completed their prison sentence, which is why Just Future Project's campaign is release on release date. And I would tell you, we've had dozens of legislative meetings, and we have not spoken to a single elected official so far in Virginia who has actually been able to tell us that they disagree with the premise that when, at a very fundamental level, when a person has repaid their debt to society, when they have completed their prison sentence, they get to go home. And these systems are just designed to indefinitely warehouse them in cages after the completion of their sentence.
So, Galen, this is Nkechi. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's so good to hear your voice, Nkechi.
Always good to hear your voice. So, I know recently there was a bill that was introduced in Virginia to abolish the state system of pretrial, pre-crime. This pre-crime thing. What was that movie? There was some kind of movie dealing with pre-crime.
Oh, yeah. It's called Minority Report. It was Tom Cruise in 2002.
Right. So to abolish that system's pre-crime preventative detention, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, and I hats off to Senator Joseph Morrissey. He's a Democrat from Richmond, for his moral fortitude in attempting to make Virginia a leader away from these dystopian Kafkaesque systems. The bill is a clean repeal. It would simply remove this statute from the code books in Virginia and take us back to what 30 states are already doing, which is using the criminal legal system to address harm. And, you know, when they first created these laws, the excuse for them was that they needed a stopgap measure, quote-unquote, to capture people who had already been sentenced but had been sentenced incorrectly or not long enough or whatever. And they passed this law originally in 1999 in Virginia. They've had every opportunity and have taken it in Virginia again and again and again to do nothing but increase the penalties for criminal behavior in the Commonwealth. And so the premise that we, you know, need a system because the sentences aren't, like, the sentences couldn't be any longer.
So this bill, is there precedent throughout the country on this, or is this the first time this is being, a bill such as this has been in effect?
A lot of people have been asking that question, and as far as we can tell, no one has ever proposed dismantling one of these systems in one of the state legislatures or at the federal level since the first law was introduced in 1990.
Wow. So what the teacher just said and what you just said, it surprises me that nobody submitted a bill like this, sexually violent predators, this pre-crime prevention detention where they lock you up on what they think you might do in the future. It's like one of the caseworkers is as a crystal ball, and they say, we're not going to release you because you might do something in the future. And because of what we think you might do, you're not going home. That's a violation of all basic principles of law. You got a constitutional right, man, to be confronted with your accuser, and your time is up. You serve your time, and they still can hold you past your time that the judge sentenced you if they make a determination that you might commit another crime in the future.
Sitting in my cage, altogether it's been 51 months past my release date, I have spent in a carceral setting, and I've never actually been committed to the shadow prison in Virginia. That's what we call it. We don't, they pretend it's a behavioral rehabilitation center. It's all just terrible PR branding. It looks like a prison, it talks like a prison, it has barbed wires and a punitive intent like a prison. So we call it a shadow prison. These people are essentially disappeared to this facility downstate. but sitting in my cage, there was something fundamentally broken about these laws in the social contract between me as an individual and the state. The state claiming that they could somehow know my mind and as a result know what I would or would not do in the future is preposterous. And let me talk just briefly about the psychology here. The American Psychiatric Association, so these are the people with MDs who are the arbiters of what is and is not legitimate involuntary medical psychiatric commitment, have said for 22 years, after an exhaustive 5-year study, they concluded in 1998, that these laws are nothing more than a bastardization of the medical model of civil commitment, that they are another name for a cage, a legislative intent to contain people twice for the same crime, without any valid psychological basis. And one of the core concepts they point to, which I think will startle many of your listeners, Roach and Ikichi, is that they're essentially medicalizing crime. So the state argues that because you committed a crime, you must have some psychological problem. And as a result of that psychological problem, they can predict that you must be likely to commit future crime. So there's this circular logic to this that the American Psychiatric Association so deeply objected to, and virtually none of the people in these facilities are diagnosed with legitimate psychological disorders. There are some, and what they've done is try to create labels. For example, my favorite is they try to create a psychological disorder to mirror the crime of sexual assault, right? So it turns out that the psychiatrists have said all along that people don't commit sexual assault because they have some sort of psychological disorder that makes them commit sexual assault. Any more than, you know, a straight man who's attracted to a woman, you know, rapes a woman because he's attracted to a woman. They commit a crime because they didn't respect the other person. They made a moral choice. And our system is about holding people accountable for that moral choice and helping them reintegrate into the society at the end. The people who prostitute their professional credentials to the state to try to support these pre-crime preventative detention systems tried to come up with this term, rapophilia.
Rapophilia.
It is not in the DSM. It is not recognized. Many of the people in, you know, we laugh because it's absurd, right, that they're so transparently trying to create a diagnostic label, a pretextual diagnostic label, as a basis to indefinitely detain somebody in a quote-unquote treatment center after they complete their prison sentence, when it's just obvious that this is the crime of, you know, a rape that they are trying to turn into a mental disorder. and 30 states don't do this. But let me talk briefly about the racism data, because this is sort of a sticking point for a lot of folks. And it speaks to the ability of these systems to predict whether somebody is or is not going to commit a future crime. The label in Virginia says the person is so likely to commit a future act of sexual violence. It's a statutory term, so likely, that they constitute a menace to the health and safety of others. So keywords, so likely, and menace. They have let out, as of last March 1st, 483 people who were designated as so likely to reoffend in Virginia that they constituted a menace. So as part of my own case, we asked Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services, which is like the mental health agency in Virginia, we asked them, so these people in your custody who you've now released as so likely to reoffend, how many of them actually reoffended? I mean, how many of these people labeled as so likely to commit a future act of sexual violence actually committed one of those acts?
The answer, how many was it?
It's two people out of 483. That is a recidivism rate of 0.4%.
2% recidivism rate.
0.4%. So it's two persons, one, two people, and it's a percentage of 0.4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and these are the people that had been labeled so likely that they, based on some sort of volitional impairment causing psychological problem. So there are two possibilities. The first possibility is that Virginia just sucks at determining who is or who is not likely to reoffend, which is probably true if you, you know, take a second to look at the bias system that they use. Or what the American Psychiatric Association has said all along is true, which is that this population that they claim to be targeting doesn't even exist. So the reality is that, you know, people who, you know, cause serious harm in our system, and many people who never cause serious harm, get incredibly long prison sentences now. And, you know, people like Nkechi and you are trying to change that. I'd like to be part of the solution. But the reality right now is that, you know, most of these guys are getting out, if they, you know, had serious criminal histories, they're getting out of prison, if at all, when they're very, very old and incredibly unlikely to reoffend.
And they age out of crime. They age out of
crime.
Precisely. Let me ask you this, Galen. Who makes the determination? You said you'd done 51 months past your release date and they held you in custody without a charge on this Sexual Violent Predator Act. Who makes the determination? I guess what I'm asking is, now they got somebody in the correctional field who can foretell the future. They got a crystal ball. They can say, what Gaylor going to do, you can break the law again. These people should be in every prison system around the world. If they can predict who going to break the law again, and they holding you on what somebody else think you might do, and you've been locked up 51 months. Did you get any compensation, financial compensation, or anything for keeping you 51 months past your release date?
No, and the second time, the jury actually voted against me, so I had literally the same trial twice. Well, the first one was in 2012. After waiting for 2.5 years almost, and then the second one was in late September, October of 2019. Let me try that again. It was the exact same accusation from the state, you know, the same fraudulent diagnosis. And what's, you know, fascinating about the second time is that there's a process in Virginia where the commissioner of DBHDS, which is our mental health agency, is required by the statute to appoint a quote-unquote independent evaluator. I don't really think they're independent at all because they're financially beholden to the state and they work very closely with the prosecutors. But, you know, fine, independent. That person concluded that I did not qualify under the statute. So what did the Attorney General's office do but go out and hire their own hand-picked expert, asking them to not complete a mental health assessment or a mental health examination, as the term in the statute, but to just simply do a file review. And they based their petition on that person. And then they proceeded to hire her for more hours than she had spent for the entire other 23 cases she had done under the statute. So 24 cases she'd done altogether. This all came out through the subpoena data in my case. She did 23 of them legitimately under the DBHDS system. She did one case for the AG's office, and she spent 108 billable hours as of our subpoena result, which is about a month before the trial. Yeah. When the question is purely subjective and it's about quote-unquote risk, you know, the question of how high is too high for risk is purely subjective. So, you know, the actuarial tool that they use in Virginia is explicitly homophobic, for example. There's a question on it. There are only 10 questions. One of their questions is all about historical past, you know, facts about you, like your crime of conviction, things like that, your age. One of the questions is, did you have a male victim? Well, they only give this test to men, Roach. So this is a proxy for, are you gay? And if you're gay, they score you with high risk. So if you're young, gay, and did not commit incest, they think that you're automatically high risk, which is absurd. And let me just briefly say, the projection that they offer for recidivism, even under this, you know, quote unquote high risk, you get a 5 on the static 99 R. That correlates to 86% not likely to reoffend, right? So they're targeted. There is no way to do this right, which is why.
A lot of folks are not familiar with this violent sexual predator and how they can lock you up and hold you away. I can imagine when you said you did 51 months past your time and he put you in solitary, and I did a couple long stretches in solitary, and I know what that is, and I earned my way in solitary. Here you in prison, and you're not supposed to be there, and he got you in solitary. Is there a high rate of suicide or guys killing themselves because of this kind of treatment of being locked up without a charge and being forced into a prison and you can't get out?
I can't speak to rate.
Has anybody got any figures or stats on the suicide of these men and women are being held against their will for a charge that somebody said they got a crystal ball? That Galen was gonna break the law again in the future, and him and Roach got to come back. We ain't gonna release him because I think they're gonna do something wrong. That could have been used against a majority of people coming out of prison.
Exactly. That's the problem is that once the state starts, you know, basing future behavior based on historical events, you know, they claim that the past is the best predictor for the future, but it turns out that it's an actually terrible predictor. The answer to your question is no. And these systems are incredibly opaque. They treat them as a black box. They hide between quote-unquote patient confidentiality. They claim that these men who are shadow prisoners are quote-unquote patients. And so, for example, in New Jersey, where they have one of these facilities in Avenel, they literally take the guys, on their release date from the prison, walk them across the yard to the old solitary wing, which is now the quote-unquote treatment facility, place them in the treatment facility, and then record on the books that the person has been, quote, released. So if you call the prisoner and ask where they are, they'll say, oh, well, we don't know, he's been released. And if you call the mental health agency and ask where the person is, they'll say, oh, we can't, confirm or deny. So they're literally disappearing people like the Soviets used to do.
Yeah, this is not a musical sales, and they're changing the sales, and they're disappearing. Nikichi,
a colleague of mine just texted me, Fahima Sek, and said that she turned down a position as a social worker in the state of New York early in her career, and where they were holding men after their sentence who had served time for sex convictions. She said she'll call in, so maybe after the break we can hear from her, because this is a personal example, I guess, of someone turning down a position precisely because of this unconstitutionality, I would say, in terms of holding people beyond their release dates.
We're going to take a break. No, we won't take a break. We'll let people, if you wish to call in with a question for Galen or Nikichi or I, the phone number to call is 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Folks,
okay,
we talked about
trying to call, and the PFW needs to pick up the phone.
Okay. Go ahead. Folks, we talked about this a couple of times in the past, but here you can be locked up because of what they think you might do and keep you indefinitely. And this is happening all over the country. As Nikita said, this is a constitutional. You're not supposed to be incarcerated without a criminal case, without a trial, or some facts or information. They lock you up now on what they think you might do. If I went to prison and my release date, they won't let me out because they think I might rob a bank again tomorrow. But this is for violent sexual predators. And Galen said that he was in college, he had sex with somebody who was a high schooler. And because of that, he's been tagged as a violent sexual predator. And they held him 51 months past his release date because somebody suggested that he may rape or be involved with a violent sexual act again in the future. This is preposterous, people. That's like saying that any one of us who just come out of prison who don't have a job might commit another crime again. You certainly will if you don't have no money and no job and nothing to do. You know what I mean? Well, we got our call on the line right now. Come on, Khalil. We take our first caller, Khalil. You're on the air, please. Question or comment?
Yes. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. This is Sister Fahima. I just wanted to share a brief story. About 20 years ago, I was offered a position early in my career as a social worker at a place called Kirby Forensic, where they were holding men after their sentence indefinitely. And I, of course, declined the position because I knew it was a class action lawsuit in my view. And I know in the state of New York 20 years ago, they were holding men who had, after they had served their time for sex offenses, they were holding them indefinitely. They told me, you don't have to do any discharge planning, just do groups. And because there was no light at the end of the tunnel, I didn't think it was a good idea to take that position.
Huh. And that was only in New York. Is other states doing the same thing?
Yes, the state of New York. This was Finley Forensic, which is a state facility, and they were these were prisons. These were jails, prisons rather, and they were holding these men after they had completed their sentences, and they were holding them indefinitely, and I wasn't something I wanted to be part of. It sounded like a class action suit about to happen. Anyway, that's all I wanted to share, and thank you for taking my
call. Let me ask you this.
Hold on, let's see if Galen has any commentary on that before you hang up. Galen?
I thank her for, her ethical decision. I think too many people are prostituting their professional credentials to the state, and it's just, this is a cottage industry. People are making lots and lots of money. And it's wonderful to hear somebody that had, you know, the moral courage to say that these systems are wrong and choose to do something else with their life.
Thank you.
Let me ask this question. Is this only for people who got sexual offenses? What about somebody, a bank robber or stick-up boy?
Well,
I haven't heard of them being held past the release date. So this has only been used, applied for people with violent sexual offenses?
As the gentleman said, it was a civil commitment program, and they had already served their time, but they were not going to release them, and they were holding them indefinitely. And it just, there was no light at the end of the tunnel. And I didn't see, you know, because as social workers, we're helping people to get on to the next level, the next step. And they just wanted me to do groups and no discharge planning.
Well, that's cool.
I think we have two more callers on the line.
Oh, Bruce, if I could respond briefly to what she just said. There was a large federal lawsuit out of Minnesota, and the judge said that the one single characteristic that could characterize these systems is the hopelessness of the men stuck in them.
Oh, wow. That's cold-blooded. Well, we'll take our next caller, please. Hello, we'll take our next caller.
Hey.
Hello, you're on the air, please. You're on the air.
Hey, Rose, this is Jabari Zakia. When I was on your show in 2019 talking about supervised release, this is exactly the purpose of why those laws were instituted in the middle of the Reagan years, in the middle of the 1980s. The whole purpose of, I think people need to understand what's really going on. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Constitution. This is purely political and economic. They are concocting a way to keep predominantly black and non-white people in prison without having to go through the exercise of actually having to convict them for a crime. 35% of the people in the federal system, at least 35%, are there for technical violations of supervised release.
Right.
And supervised release is unconstitutional. So, and the black politicians go along with it, the black caucus go along with it, the judges, the lawyers, ACLU goes along with it, the sentencing project go along with it, because they don't attack it at its root as being fundamentally unconstitutional, and anything that comes after it is fruit from a poison tree. So yes. Then what needs to happen is the public has to understand that they politicize and demonize people on all these fronts. They demonize you on the sexual front. They demonize you as a menace to society and so forth. And most of us buy it. Most of us, when we are asked, should people be put in prison who have a potential to rape your little, you know, your son or daughter, they say, yeah, throw them in prison. They could care less about the Constitution until it happens to them or somebody they know. So I'm just saying that you shouldn't be surprised, but the way to combat this has to be a two-front approach. There needs to be a active or concerted issue by different law groups to attack it on a fundamental constitutional basis. But ultimately, this is going to be a political issue, and people who are going to have to go into these offices in Congress and the state legislature with the mindset that we're going to end this thing, and we're going to have to create a society so that people have the money, the housing, and the other essential needs, so they don't get stressed out and do these irrational things that are bound to happen when you put rats in a cage and then you take away all their resources. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for calling in, Jabari.
Just a couple of things Jabari said. Galen? Yeah, so you know, one of the things he pointed at right there at the end there is the concept of primary prevention. Which is the idea of, you know, instead of just punishing quote-unquote no defenders, people who've already been held accountable for their offenses, you know, the vast majority of sex-related crime is committed by over 95%, according to DOJ, of sex-related crime is committed by somebody who's not on any list. They don't have any prior conviction. And so the states that just focus on the 5% of crime that's committed by somebody who had a prior are by definition ignoring 95% of the problem, and the premier victim rights and survivor groups around the country and at the national level have said for years that the best way to prevent sexual violence and child abuse is primary prevention. We don't invest in that as a society, and Virginia had put $750,000 per year for 2 years on the books. When COVID happened and there was a $1 billion budget shortfall, they cut it from the budget, so it was not actually funded, and that was the primary prevention budget for Virginia. Meanwhile, they spent $110 million to expand the warehouse facility where they hold these men, the shadow prison. That's 258 beds, which comes out to $426,000 per bed to warehouse people in a cage after the completion of their prison sentence. And the best part is when they funded this, the $110 million, DBHDS admitted that they would run out of beds again in less than 2 years.
Is there anybody tagging this issue on as a class action nationally all across the country? Because this is happening all over the country, man. What can be done, or what's being done, to attack this? I know the legislation that was submitted recently by Joe Morris
in Virginia. SB 1244. Yeah. And by the way, that piece of legislation, the chief co-patron on the House side is Delegate Patrick Hope, who is chairman of the Judiciary Committee. So this bill has, you know, some real legs to it. The answer to your question is, the lawyers, you guys know what the Supreme Court's like these days. There was a, 5-4 decision back in 1997 that green-lighted these laws. Kennedy was the swing vote, and, you know, he laid out in his concurring opinion the path to demonstrating that these laws are, in fact, unconstitutional because they are not the lie that was told to the U.S. Supreme Court. There was a case 3 years ago that came up for review, and the Supreme Court denied cert. So I think the lawyers are largely discouraged. The advocates are not. People on the ground who are trying to demonstrate a politically relevant constituency, there are so many families who are deeply impacted by these laws. I hear horror stories on a daily basis of kids that are homeless because their dad gets picked up for a technical violation while he's on supervised release under this program. You know, all sorts of deep harm that's being caused to the community, and those people are starting to come together. They're starting to say, hell no, this is not, you know, the Jeffersonian values that our democracy was founded on, and this has got to go.
Hey, Galen, what can people do who are listening to the show and might run into somebody who's being held illegally for on this violent sexual predator civil commitment law? What can folks do? Is there a number to call or something?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me give you guys the number.
Please give us some information.
Yeah, the number is 202-350.
202-350.
Yep. 0531.
0531.
Yeah, and the website is ajustfuture.org.
Ajustfuture.
Yep. And, it's easy to remember. We believe in a just future. We're working to build a just future.
Okay. All right, so people can call that number for information on what they can do if they've run into somebody who's expressing the same situation. Because this is, we've been talking about your case a couple of times on the show, Galen. And this is, I'm glad you're home, man. I'm glad to see that you're getting involved. And, you know, things happen to people for different reasons that we can't even see or understand. But maybe, man, but since you've been a part of this, you're in a good position, man. You understand the ins and outs, and maybe you can help direct folk, man, to see what we can do to get this thing overturned, because this is a national issue. This ain't just in Virginia. This is happening all over the country.
So, Roach, the people working to abolish these systems, they're on the right side of history, and this is going to happen, eventually one way or the other. We're just trying to make it happen faster to get these people back to their communities.
Go ahead, Nikichi.
So we have another caller. We have another caller on the line. The number is 202-588-0893. Oh, that's the PFW number, but I think
God, the PFW are calling you, Kichi.
Okay, we got another call on. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, I had
you're on the air. Question or comment, please.
I had a question for you, gentlemen. First, I wanted to say I'm sorry to hear you went through that issue. But I had a question, and I missed the early part of the of his commentary. I wanted to know what he went to jail for. Does he believe that he did break the law? And in his mind, why did he do it? And what does he think? Let's say they hadn't done that, the unconstitutional, given him extra time. I don't know if that affected him or not, but does he believe that he maybe would commit that kind of a crime again? And the next question, but follow up, is how, what does he believe is the way that you talk about different therapists? How can they, what's the best way to approach the prevention before it happens? And then also to rehabilitate those who have done it to try to make sure they don't do it again. So what is his comment on that?
Let's take your first two questions. Come on, we ain't got much time. Take your first two. All right, Galen.
Sure, I'll jump in. It was kind of hard to hear the gentleman, but I'll jump in. So I think the question was, do I think that I broke the law? I absolutely broke the law when I was 19. I was 19. I'm 37 now. That was 18 years ago. I haven't been accused of a crime in 18 years. And these systems are designed to label people based on criminal behavior and just never let them go. It's permanent, unending punishment with no end in sight and no point to it. This does not make society safer. It doesn't. They tell me that they're helping me not commit crimes by taking away all of my civil liberties, and that's not true. I don't need help not committing crimes, as you know, the 4 years that I was out before clearly shows. And so the second question is, what does primary prevention look like? Stop the crimes before they happen. There is this foundational myth that sex is different. Americans believe this, and it's not true. The people commit sexual crimes for many of the same reasons that sorts of other crimes. People had way too much to drink and act impulsively. People were young, dumb, and, made a really bad life choice. And many of the people in these systems, committited their offense when they were teenagers. There was one young man who was 14, and he had a consensual relationship with a girlfriend at his middle school, who was a slightly younger than him, and Virginia, in all of its infinite wisdom, committed him. It's ridiculous. But the primary prevention basically targets things that we know in the rest of the criminal legal system, really help people on the reentry side, for example, or help stem crime to begin with. Education, for example, invest in education and people, the crime rates fall dramatically. Housing, employment, these basic core aspects of life. But then also, like specifically on the sexual side, educating young people, about these systems and about consent and harm. And those are sorts of things that dramatically can reduce harm before it occurs.
Okay. We got a couple of minutes to go. Nikichi, you want to give us some brief closing remarks on before we get away from you?
Yeah, I just want to really thank Galen. I'd like to thank Dr. Bonita Thompson,
yes,
and Galen's mom, Garnett, for really bringing this issue to our attention really over the past couple of years. I know we on Crossroads have highlighted this issue, bringing it out from under the rug and from behind the corners, trying to bring it into the forefront. I know at the Justice Roundtable, I've had folk on, so we're just trying to help shine a light on issues such as this. So thank you for lending your voice and helping to educate the WPFW community here. So that's all I would like to say, Ron.
And thank you. And again, I just want to echo what she just said to Dr. Thompson and to your mother. Thank the man. Without your mother, Galen, you'd probably still be in there. Your mother has been a tornado.
It's true. It's the women that do the work that move us forward in these.
There you go. There you go. You said the magic word. Women do the majority of this work in criminal justice to bring about these changes. Whether they're attorneys, mothers, sisters, wives, or whatever. Women are there. And your mother, boy, I mean, she has been on the forefront fighting your case along with Dr. Thompson about her son. So I want to thank you all for bringing these topics to us that we can share with everybody. You want to say something to Keisha?
Yeah, just real quick. Still waiting for William Underwood's release. They're waiting for the count to clear before they let him out. But this is a second by second situation. So I just wanted to say that.
Let me share something. Our time is running out. And yesterday was Martin Luther King's birthday. And I wrote a poem in 1968. One of my poems I wrote, that Marion Barry used to like this poem. I wrote it in a Southern dialect. And it was in the Ebony magazine of a black lady standing on a corner. And she had just heard that King had been shot. And she had two bags in her hand. She's looking up at the sky. And her stockings was rolled down around her ankles. And she had a look in her face that said, "Carry me home, Lord. They's done it again. And times ain't the way you want them, Lord. They say nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Lord, that nobody must be you. Because everybody knows I've seen nothing but trouble and killing and suffering of black folk. And I've cried for them that's done gone. Some eyes didn't know personal like, Lord, like the dreamer. What for it happened, Lord? What for? I cried when they got Mega. I've cried when they bummed the chilling. Now they's got the dreamer. And eyes can't cry no more. He dripping your place, Lord. Like the one you got for us up in glory. Where's our place at, Lord? Is it anywhere? Eyes are mighty tired, and they killing them so young, and eyes can't cry no more. Can you hear me, Lord? Eyes can't cry no more. Carry me home, Lord. Carry me home.
Wow, you a poet too, folks?
I wrote that back in Lawton back in the day, and that was to a painting, a drawing, a picture that was in the Ebony magazine when King got assassinated, and this lady stood on the corner, and that picture just touched me. And a friend of mine, Baby George Stewart, drew a picture of this lady, and I took the picture and put a poem to it, and the poem says, "Carry me home, Lord, I was tired." And what the line that really gets me is, "Where's our place at, Lord? Is it anywhere?" Everybody knows we've been going through this, so there's a couple more poems I'll share with you from time to time, but that's what I wrote about Martin Luther King. And believe me, because of King's death, I'm here today. He motivated and inspired me in ways that I never could imagine. I never met nobody or read about somebody who risked their life for us and didn't get paid. He didn't get a dime. He was not about to make money. He was about making a change. And I want to thank Dr. King and all the folks that worked with him and make this reality. And to everybody that made our show this morning a success, to Galen Boffman, to your mother, man, who made sure we got on top of this with Dr. Benita Thompson. Thank y'all. And keep up the good work, Galen. Let us know what we can do to keep the word out there. And please, somebody got to get on board and work with him and help, because this issue is affecting people all over the country. They're locking folk up and holding you without a trial, without a conviction, because they think you might commit another offense in the future. That is crazy. That ain't Juggy Boogie. I kiss my shoe. That's Juggy Boogie. Okay? So until the next time, my name is Roach Brown. My co-host is Nikichi Taifa, my beautiful wife, Mertine Brown, Jackie Craig Bay, and of course, to Khalifa, our engineer. Thanks to everybody for making this show a reality. Until next time, remember, your inner voice is never wrong. Merry Christmas.
Is anybody here? See my old friend Ariel. Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but the good, they died young. 'Cause I looked around one day and the man was gone. What a shame, he was gone. Listen. Anybody here seen my old friend Martin?
Can you tell me where the man gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seems a good died young. I turned my head one day and the man was gone. Lord, he was gone. Didn't you love the things they stood by? Didn't they try to find some good for you and me? And we'll be free someday. Soon it's gonna be one day. Has anybody here seen my old friend John? Ooh, can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people.